The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
This is a very busy Wednesday here at the Brad Sessmatt Show, Sports 360 AZ. I'm Jordan Hamm, hosting today with Devin Henry on the other side of the glass. Thanks so much for joining us. Make sure to check out all of our content on Sports 360 AZ. Follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, all the social medias for all of our content. So going to have Greg Esposito, Espo, friend of Sports 360 AZ, also one of the hosts of the Suns Solar Panel podcast, and a longtime Phoenix Suns employee, join us to talk about the Phoenix Suns debut tonight. NBA season kicked off last night. Suns kicking things off here in 2019-2020 tonight. We're going to talk about his expectations. It feels like it's been a longer off season than usual. I feel like the take machines have been flying on the NBA and the Phoenix Suns as a whole, but we're going to be talking to him. Always entertaining when we have Espo join us, but going to also be talking some World Series, ASU, Cardinals, a lot to get to. Again, a busy time of year with what's been going on in the sports world. So let's waste no time and get to our rundown brought to you by Sagicor Now. Sagicor Now, protect what matters most. So the Nationals able to escape with the Game 1 victory in the World Series over the Houston Astros. We're going to get to more of that here in a second. But I think the thing that has been all over my timeline, been on the front of my mind a lot, has been just this outburst that the assistant GM of the Astros had after they clinched the ALCS to three female reporters, screaming, "I'm so glad we got Roberto Ozuna," who is a reliever who has a domestic violence history, was suspended from the league for a significant amount of time because of that. And so that is bad enough. Like, obviously, that is horrible. And the thing that bugs me the most just is seeing so many, you know, and this is in the state, across the country, I see so many talented reporters who are female, who bust their butts, are well-researched, are a lot of times more put together than their male counterparts, or really just any of the other reporters in the room, because they have to. If they're off their game, people seem to notice more so than I can just waltz in and just give somewhat educated takes and everybody just kind of, you know, glosses over. But seeing the things that some of these reporters have had to deal with just doing their jobs. That's all they're trying to do. Just do their jobs, do it well, and, you know, be a successful reporter. You know, that's all that's really trying to happen here. So this happens, which is bad enough. And then the Astros double down that the report from one of these reporters, they questioned her credibility. They questioned the story as a whole, and that's Stephanie Abstein of Sports Illustrated. And they just went through and really doubled down without, it seems like, not really knowing the entire story. And multiple reporters have come out and said, like, no, that's exactly what happened. And it's just one of those things where the team, they're clearly in the wrong, and they double down to protect one of their own for making a very ill-advised and just awful remarks to some of these reporters. And then they just, without really the information, just go on, and they've since retracted that and, kind of taken a few steps back. Really haven't seen much of an apology, if any. And so it's one of those things. It's unfortunate that we're taking time away from the World Series, the pinnacle of baseball, what's been a great postseason so far, to talk about this dumbass of a Astros staffer that should be fired. Yeah, I'll say it. He should be fired. I don't think that's a very hot take. But who knows what's going to happen with this. Again, the Astros have really butchered this in a lot of ways. And we'll see what progresses out of this. But it's one of those things that I have heard stories, I've seen firsthand, a lot of things that female reporters have to go through that I don't have to go through because I walk through the door and I'm a man. So there's already an assumed, oh, you know what you're talking about. There are a lot of football reporters that are female that walk through that instantly are assumed are less credible or know less about what they're talking about than I do, who has played very little football in their life, who has done his homework and knows, you know, has a good handle on the game, I feel like, but does a lot of research, but they can do the exact same amount of research, and if not more, which in some cases that's very true, and they know more than I do, but they'll instantly, their knowledge base, their credibility will be called into question before that, just because I'm a man, they're a woman. That's not right. It's just, it's flat out not. Yet if it was a complete flip situation, that would not be happening. So we'll get to actually what happened on the field now with the World Series. Nationals, again, a good game one victory. And the strategies of postseason managers. I love how things just completely, really, like, kind of strategies kind of digress at some point in the World Series when it's like, all right, we got four wins we got to get. We're going to throw out three starters in one game, or we're going to have our setup guy go three innings and, you know, oh, runner on first, a potentially high leverage situation. We're going to put our best relievers in there. I think back, this was the early 2000s with the Marlins. It seemed like every time a base runner got on, when he wasn't starting the game, Josh Beckett came out. Like, that dude just had a rubber arm in that World Series run, because it felt like any time there was a potential that one of their opponents could score a run, Josh Beckett was coming out. And it's just like, well, there may not be any feeling in this thing right now, but we're going to go ahead and just get after it. So with the Nationals, Max Scherzer, a strong start against a really good Houston Astros team. Look, they're gonna score their runs. Patrick Corbin, who was perceived but not yet announced to the Game 3 starter, throws in relief. Daniel Hudson comes in, throws a lot of pitches. He's the setup man for that group. But he throws a ton of pitches in Game 1. And then Sean Doolittle with a 4-out save as well. So we'll see if there are ramifications, if there is, you know, what happens in Game 3. Is it going to be Patrick Corbin that makes that start? Will he be more tired? You know, will he not be as effective in Game 3? That's something we just have to keep an eye out for. But it's one of those things, I feel like, where the Houston Astros, it's kind of the best team versus the hottest team. Right now, and a lot of times we've seen in World Series runs, it's a lot of times it's the hottest team that can outplay the best team. And yeah, the Nationals have had a bit of time off. It didn't seem like there was much rust for that team. You know, Juan Soto, holy crap, like that guy is just writing, you know, the living legend narrative as we speak right now. This guy is 20 and just with, what, three hits, a huge home run, a monster home run off Garrett Cole, who has been bulletproof all season, and especially at home. But he's making people forget about Bryce Harper very quickly, and with all of these clutch moments. And you have him, you have Ryan Zimmerman, who, like, the ageless wonder. We talked about him last week. He's continuing to just have an incredible series. So Game 1 goes to the Nationals. We'll see what happens with Game 2. Obviously going to be a huge matchup with Steven Strasburg and with Justin Verlander going toe-to-toe in Houston. So good start to the World Series. Again, I think the postseason has been very exciting so far, and just overall been a really competitive one in what has seemed to be a regular season where it seemed like, all right, it's going to be Astros, potentially Yankees, and Dodgers just going to run the course. Let's run this back. We've seen this song and dance before. It's been an exciting postseason. So always love when things kind of get turned on their heads a little bit. Coming up next, we're going to talk some football, going to talk a little bit Cardinals, a little bit of ASU before we get to Greg Esposito. Cardinals making some moves in the backfield. We'll find out who that is coming up next. Welcome back to the Brad Sesmatch Show. Going to talk some ASU, some Cardinals, also a little bit of U of A, but first, the big news that I just saw on my Twitter feed. Not only will Cardi B be joining Fast and Furious 9, but apparently Fast and Furious writers have met with Keanu Reeves for a possible role. Now, look, I know that franchise is not for everybody. It is, in my opinion, the perfect movies series to just sit down, shut your mind off, not worry about really much in terms of potential storytelling, physics, but they are just highly entertaining movies. And they really did a great job extending this franchise in the fifth movie, bringing in The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and then having these great villains who then all of a sudden just joined the team the next movie. So we're expecting Idris Elba, I think, potentially as a part of the team in the next movie. But then you bring in Keanu Reeves. I mean, John Wick. Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Devin Henry's just putting his face into his computer, trying not to make eye contact, and hoping that I move on from Fast and Furious talk. On the Cardinals front, signed two running backs. It's not Jay Ajayi, as they had worked out previously, but Alfred Morris and Zach Zenner. Alfred Morris, first made his big appearance on the national stage as a Washington Redskin, spent some time as Ezekiel Elliott's backup with the Cowboys, now an 8-year vet and joining the Cardinals. And then Zach Zenner recently released by the New Orleans Saints, who the Cardinals play this week. And based on what I'm seeing from the reporting of Catherine Fitzgerald, friend of Sports 360 AZ, AZ Central sports reporter, does a great job. You should follow her at KFitz 134. But she relayed this message that the Cardinals have signed those two. A big part of that was for practice purposes to keep Chase Edmonds from having too big a load during the week to keep him fresh coming off the best game of his career. Kingsbury would like to have Johnson play on Sunday, but that's still up in the air. So obviously that depth is useful to the Arizona Cardinals. And one thing that I saw Darren Urban point out that might shine a light a little bit more on the state of where David Johnson's at with his various injuries. He may not be all that ready to go. Obviously you want to, keep Chase Edmonds fresh while he's in shorts, for Sunday for the game. I don't know if you bring in a veteran type unless David Johnson is ready to go 100%. And it just, based on the Monday presser that I was at, Kingsbury just kind of said he didn't quite look right. The conditions certainly played a role because it was very rainy, tough to get, a good grip on the field and, making various cuts. But could that mean that David Johnson is out for a couple of more weeks? I'm not really sure. If Chase Edmonds has the production that he has, the Cardinals can certainly still have production from that position. But I think as we've seen this offense progress, they're at their best when they can have multiple guys going in the backfield. You move David Johnson out to a slot where he's lined up on a linebacker. That's been real effective. Much like opponents with tight ends, that's been a good matchup for the Cardinals, is having David Johnson be able to outrun linebackers in the passing game. And he's caught some big touchdowns from Kyler Murray in that scenario. So I don't think it's a this or that. I think that the Cardinals' offense is at their best. It's like a college offense where you can cycle in a bunch of running backs and just keep guys fresh and keep them in different roles. So we'll see how Alfred Morris fits into that Obviously, I think if David Johnson is fully healthy and ready to go, we won't see much of Alfred Morris, but the depth, obviously, when you have your star running back in David Johnson as in an emergency role, you have a depth problem when things clearly aren't right for him. So you have a depth problem. They were able to address that this week. But looking at the Cardinals, I mean, what? They start 0-3-1, rattle off three straight wins, and are in, really hitting their stride. But it'll be interesting to see moving forward, because this is when, look, say, like, I'm not going to discount an NFL win, but those are teams that most teams should beat. When you're looking at, the Bengals, arguably the worst team in the NFL, a bad Falcons team, and a struggling Giants team with a half-healthy Saquon Barkley, they did what they're supposed to do against those teams. And it's encouraging to see, because even those games last year were a struggle for the Cardinals. But this is when things really ramp up for the Arizona Cardinals. They have to go to New Orleans. They host a really good 49ers team on a short week. So you're getting arguably the two best NFC teams back-to-back weeks in the span of 11 days. Then you go on the road to the Buccaneers, on the road to the 49ers, host the Rams, host the Steelers, who should be getting Mason Rudolph back soon, host the Browns, on the road at the Seahawks, and then they host the Rams. So how many more wins do you see coming the Cardinals' way in this second-ish half of the season? I mean, three, maybe? You know, this is a tough part of the season, but I think you say to any Cardinals fan after the season that they went through last year, 3-13, say, hey, they could be 6-10 with Kyler Murray, Cliff Kingsbury. Yeah, there's a lot of work that the roster has to be done on the roster. I think Cardinals fans would take that. And you think, you know, especially early on in the season, Cardinals are interception in overtime, potential pick six away from winning that game against the Lions. All of a sudden, you're 7-9. A couple balls bounce the other way against the Ravens, and that's a win. Then all of a sudden, they're 8-8. By that same token, we can play the other side of that game, and that tie can be a loss. And some of these close wins, I mean, the Giants came storming back. They could have definitely overtaken that one. I mean, the margin of victory between these three wins is 8 points. So things could really, it's sticking with the narrative of, wow, they are way, you know, they were this close to rattling off 2 to 3 more wins, and also this close to it being so much worse. So, and that's the NFL by nature, but I feel like, especially with the Cardinals, it's been that they could they missed an opportunity or two to really take advantage of some wins. And also, oh, those three wins easily could have been three losses. So, but it's entertaining football. It really is. I was really against, I thought Josh Rosen deserved another year to see what he could do. But with Cliff Kingsbury, with Kyler, they have made a move for improvement. Now, I'm not saying that Josh Rosen, if he were given another year here, he wouldn't have improved and been a serviceable NFL quarterback, because I think he went from a bad situation to a worse situation with Miami, and this is how you break a young potential franchise quarterback. I don't know where he goes from here, especially if Miami drafts a quarterback and he could be on the block again, his third team in 3 years, after really not doing anything wrong necessarily in this league, because he had absolutely nothing around him for his first two seasons. And frankly, that was kind of the case with him at UCLA too. He didn't, the talent level around him was not really up to par either. But that being said, they went the bold route. They took Kyler Murray. He has shown those bits of greatness and being a franchise quarterback. He's also had a couple boneheaded plays, but every rookie quarterback is going to have those. And now it's just, let's see. All right, you've shown what you can do against a bad Bengals defense, a bad Falcons defense, a bad Giants defense. Now let's see what you can do against the Saints with Cam Jordan breathing down your neck. Now let's see what you can do with two games against the 49ers coming up, which arguably has the best front seven in football. Now let's see what you can do against a pretty, I would say, an up and down Rams defense. But when they are playing well, they are in the top third of the league defensively. So this is going to be a good litmus test to kind of see Kyler Murray has his feet under him. This offense is progressing. We've seen it change every week and adjust and adapt. Now let's see him adapt to good defenses. I think they could, you know, sneak out a win against a team that nobody is seeing right now. I think they could also, drop a game against a bad team coming up. That's just the nature of the NFL and the nature of this team. But we'll see not only how this offense progresses, but now how this defense progresses with Patrick Peterson in there and the confidence that he brings. Coming up next, we got Espo coming in. Greg Esposito, host of the Suns Solar Panel. We're going to talk about the Suns season opener tonight, his thoughts on the 2019-2020 season, the worst takes that he heard during the offseason, and so much more. That's coming up next on the Brad Sussman Show. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it has felt like a long offseason, but the Suns season is here, and that means that I wanted to bring on just one individual who could help encapsulate what the season might look like, what this offseason was like, and that is Greg Esposito. Espo, the one and only host of the Suns Solar Panel. Espo, thanks so much for joining us.
Really, I was the only one. I was guessing I was about eighth on the list, but it's very nice of you to say I was the only one. And it has been a long offseason, but I feel like it's been a productive one at least.
And that was my first question I wanted to get into. It is kind of a interesting route that was taken, moving on from Josh Jackson, TJ Warren, the talent in which the way they were able to move on from it may not have been the most efficient or effective. But how much better do you think this Suns roster is from where it was last year?
Well, I think if you look at the moves individually, including draft night trade, who they drafted, all these things. If you look at them in a vacuum, you would go, these are some very bizarre moves. I don't understand why you'd give up on TJ Warren for cash considerations, why you'd send picks to get rid of Josh Jackson. All these questions. Was Ricky Rubio's contract too lucrative? You know, in a vacuum, each individual thing you could be a little confused by. But when you look at it in its totality, the moves make a lot of sense. It all comes together and gives you a team that's much more, a much smarter basketball team, a higher basketball IQ. You have a point guard for the first time in forever. I mean, some would argue Eric Bledsoe wasn't even really a true point guard, so this is your first true point guard since Goran Dragic was on the roster, one that can pass particularly well. You now have veterans that can play, a head coach that has the respect and the voice in the locker room to gain the trust of players. All of a sudden you go, this is an NBA roster. This is an NBA quality team. And that is something we have not been able to say in an off season in a very long time, despite there being some weird ways that we got.
NBA fans need to pass the time somehow during the offseason, and a lot of times that can produce takes and hot takes. What's the worst hot take you heard about the Suns team this offseason?
That Devin Booker will never be a star because he doesn't want to be double-teamed in pickup games. That was one of the dumbest things I have heard in a very long time, and one of the most annoying things possible. Devin Booker takes so much heat because Earl Watson made the decision to push him for 70 points in a game against the Boston Celtics, right? What was Devin Booker supposed to do in that game? Just throw the ball away, not try to score? And it was Earl Watson that made the decision to put him out there and continually put him out there in that game. And yet he's taken so much heat for that since then, including this ridiculous double-team take. The other one was this whole marching Gortat brothel on two wheels thing this week. That was entertaining, but led to takes where people were like, marching Gortat should shut up. Was in one headline. I don't understand that take because he spoke the truth. I mean, there was it has been a dysfunctional organization for years, and this is the first offseason in a while that we haven't necessarily felt that way.
Yeah, be honest and open up. Unless it's something I don't want to hear, then just shut up. So that's always a good take. So you worked for the Suns for multiple years in a former life. What's your favorite opening night story?
Oh, I don't have one particular story necessarily, but there was nothing like walking out of the tunnel on level zero there at the arena that first night and feeling the energy of the crowd right before the game, feeling the energy of the players as they came out to warm up, and then that first time you see that intro video, and it still was special. Even I did it five different opening nights, and each of the five times there was something very special about it. And I can only imagine as a player what it feels like on opening night to go back out there and know you get to live that dream another year. So just that moment was really always best thing that there was.
Talking to Espo, Greg Esposito, host of the Sun Solar Panel. They do a pretty hefty season preview on their latest episode. Have quite a few guys from different podcasts coming in if you want to get ready to go for tonight's season opener. For this Suns team, realistically, what's the best case scenario for the 2019-2020 Phoenix Suns?
Yeah, probably 38 to 40 wins is the best case scenario. If there's no injuries, everything gels the way that we expect or we hope in terms of looking at the potential of this Suns roster. So I think it's right around there. If the chemistry is really good, and I think people vastly underrate the importance of chemistry, a good locker room, and a strong leader on the bench. If that all comes together, you may see something special like we saw in, I think it was 2013-2014, where this team won 48. They still missed the playoffs, but they were one of the surprise teams in the league. There is a very long shot that happens, but I think 38 to 40 is max. I think 33 wins is right about where they wind up in the end.
What's the worst case scenario, I should say?
Oh, Devin Booker gets injured, DeAndre Ayton doesn't develop any further, and they win 19 again. I mean, there's bust potential here too. Still, this isn't, you're not completely out of the woods. A few things go wrong, and it could spiral quick. The margin for error is very, very slim with this team. I mean, you could have Dario Saric and Frank Kaminsky not pan out. Ricky Rubio, if he's out for any extended period of time, you basically have a very similar roster to what you had for the second half of last year, which was, it was still not a great roster. So you could still wind up bottom of the barrel, low 20s, high teen wins if things go off the rails in a few key ways.
Who's the player on this roster that you're most intrigued by or want to keep an eye on, at least in the first couple months of this season?
Oh, I am irrationally excited and fascinated by Frank Kaminsky. And I'm probably the first human being to say that, at least recently. But I'm a real estate owner in Kaminsky Cove and enjoying the view so far through preseason. His potential, I think there's a chance if he plays the way he did in preseason, and he's the starting power forward for this team by December. Now, that could sound like the dumbest statement ever made come December, but that's how intrigued I am by this guy, irrationally so. I think Mikal Bridges is the guy I'm looking at and going, where is he going to wind up? Because there is a high ceiling there, and could he turn into that guy, that 3-and-D guy that everybody thinks he will be? Could he blossom into that this year, especially with Ricky Rubio on offense, getting him some open looks from beyond the arc?
Espo, we appreciate the time and the insight. Happy opening season night.
Thank you. Enjoy the game, and hopefully it's better than 2 years ago where they lost by 50 to Portland, and as good as last year when they beat Dallas.
Yeah, tale of two seasons, but really the same result. So, Espo, appreciate it. And, make sure to check out the Suns Solar Panel. Each and every week they put out really good content on this Phoenix Suns team and kind of where they're going as well. Coming up next, we are going to talk some ASU football, U of A football, kind of state of the Pac-12. Where are we going now that we are about halfway through the season with that? That's coming up next on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Appreciate Greg Esposito, Espo, for jumping on the Brad Sesmatt Show, host of the Suns Solar Panel, to help talk about the upcoming season for the Phoenix Suns. Now I want to talk some Pac-12 football. I feel like, yes, questions were answered a bit last week, but not definitively. Like I think everybody knew coming in to this year and kind of throughout the year that Utah was the best team in the Pac-12 South. I don't think there was too much of a question of that. They dropped a game or two that they shouldn't have. And I think that made some people wary that there was an opportunity. But watching that game against ASU, like, how can you not just think that that defense is elite? And it's not like that was their, defiantly best performance of the year. Like, they have been so good all year. But I'm interested to see now how ASU responds. They've responded really well after losses. They've responded really well on the road. But there have also been times they've played down to competition. I feel like ASU is a better team than Colorado. They played down to the competition and got beat. So which of these ASUs are going to show up this week against UCLA? A team that they should handle, take care of business. I think it'll be a 10-13 point win. If things go according to plan. Now, again, this is a young team. They could hit a wall. They could play down to the competition. And Chip Kelly usually has a game in him where he surprises some people. That might have already happened this year, but which ASU team is going to show up? They've been pretty darn bulletproof, with the exception of that Utah game. I guess for the entirety of the year, actually, the defense has played really well on the road. I feel like they kind of have a different mentality when they take the field on the road. They shut down Michigan State. They shut down Cal. And they held their own against Utah. It's just something finally gave, late in the game. They had a lot of scenarios where they were backed up. They forced four turnovers and no points were able to come of it. Like, that was going to be my one knock coming into this week of that ASU defense. Danny Gonzalez came into the year saying we should have 20 interceptions this year. They have not been on pace for that at all, but they forced turnovers against a good team. Four of them. Like, what else can you ask for? They keep that pace. Like, okay, now there's something to be excited about, definitely, even when the offense isn't playing well. And I feel like the offense has been fine, even against, you look back to that Michigan State game where the numbers weren't all that impressive, but they did. Jaden Daniels, we've learned, is going to take care of the football. Where I think we've seen with Kyler Murray, there are times he tries to do too much, tries to extend a play, make a 7-yard loss into a 15-yard gain, and will either run out of bounds, behind the line of scrimmage, or in the case on Sunday, get sacked within the 5-yard line, and then Giants are able to block a punt. We haven't seen Jaden Daniels do that. I think the one pass I've really seen him force is against Colorado, and that was a kind of a do or die situation, and they picked it off, and that kind of sealed the game. Other than that, you won't see him take unnecessary shots. You won't see him try to make the incredible play. He's going to make the smart play. So it might be a little bit more conservative than maybe some fans were thinking, but they aren't turning the ball over much. And again, with a good defense, that's all you can really ask for. And that's going to grow, as we've seen with the Cardinals offense. We've seen a little bit with the ASU offense, how they're able to adapt. I think they did a poor job adapting when things were going wrong against Utah. And the weather certainly played a factor. Just the overall front seven of Utah definitely played a factor. But I didn't see a lot of change of trying to get Brandon Ayuk the ball. Eno Benjamin had some started, I feel like, to find a rhythm. And maybe it was just too late in the game to really consistently try to run the ball. But that was just the one time I feel like they've been a little rigid with their play calling and kind of sticking to their approach. But it's one game. It's, I think, honestly, for a lot of people, I think if you came in and said, yeah, you're going to lose the game to Utah, a lot of people would say, okay, like that was kind of expected a little bit. But they're in a position with some big games moving forward. I take care of business against UCLA, a winnable game against USC. Oregon will certainly be a tough game. And then U of A, where kind of anything can happen. But you come out 9-3, 10-2, even 8-4. Like that's a step in the right direction to have two guys along the offensive line that are true freshmen at quarterback, a lot of youth along the defense, and be in the conversation again for a Pac-12 South title. Like, I'm curious to see how many people would be fine with the 8-4 record, or is it 9-3, 10-2, and like that's the go-to. On the other side, you have Arizona, who struggled against USC, and I feel like a lot of some of the same questions also came out. Defense struggled. The run game for USC was effective, even though they were down to like their fourth or fifth running back. Khalil Tate didn't quite look himself. Grant Gunnell got some time in there. Will we see him against Stanford? Will we see him against Oregon State the following week? Do they go into the bye week and it's kind of evaluation period for who goes the rest of the way against Oregon? And Oregon, Utah, Arizona State, like tough, really tough stretch to end the season. And that's something we talked with Justin Spears about, a couple weeks ago. So, I think you can look at, if you're U of A, I think you can be happy. You win the next two games. You drop Oregon, Utah, and then again, ASU. It's a coin flip every year. Like, no matter how good one team is, no matter how bad one team is, it's a rivalry game. As the old saying goes, throw the records out. Things are going to go a little haywire. But I think talent-wise, ASU is the more talented team. That doesn't seem to matter much. And even if you have a 19-point lead going into the fourth quarter, that doesn't seem to matter all that much either. So, but two teams, I feel like questions are still there, but it'll be... They'll continue to be answered, but a couple of winnable games for both teams this weekend. We'll see how they both respond to a couple of tough losses, and that could be kind of the setting the trend for the rest of the year moving forward. Thanks so much to Greg Esposito, Suns Solar Panel host, for joining us talking some Suns. Thanks so much to Devin Henry, the Swiss Army Knife of Sports 360 AZ, for making sure we look and sound good. I'm Jordan Hamm, and this is the Brad Sesmet Show.